Hey everyone. Before we get to my conversation with novelist Andrew Borriga, I want to take a moment to note a significant milestone. Had you asked me back in September of 2020 if I thought this podcast would make it to episode 100, I would have said, I don't know. I was in a very different place back then, and I started the show in large part because the conversations I was hearing, both locally and at a national level, around identity and other important social issues were deeply unsatisfying. And so I thought, well, if I'm not hearing the kinds of conversations I want to hear, maybe I should try having them. And with that frustration and a dozen or so cold emails to potential guests, this podcast was born. And it has become so much more than what I originally envisioned it to be. But I found it fitting to return to the topic of identity for episode 100. And in the show notes, I've linked some of my favorite conversations about this topic from the show's first year. To longtime fans who've been here since 2020 or 2021, thank you for sticking with me. I hope to do right by you and every listener by continuing to push myself to improve as a host. I'll leave you with my biggest lesson from the last 100 conversations. Whatever you're thinking of starting, whether it's a new hobby or habit or side hustle or you name it, just start. And once you do, keep at it. Because just unwrapping a gift won't really tell you what it is. To truly appreciate it, to truly understand it, you need to spend some time with it. Once you do, you might find that it gives you things you never even knew you wanted. And with that, I hope you enjoy this conversation. I certainly did. I'm your host, Michael Callahan. This is Where We Go Next. And what happens to society when we incentivize and reward victimhood? Those who've experienced real trauma, actual loss, deserve our compassion and respect. But what about people who exaggerate or even fabricate their hardships? The issues of identity and marginalization are at the forefront of many of our most covered and contentious conversations today. And every legitimate cause will attract less scrupulous actors looking to exploit it for wealth, power, and prestige. Our guest this week explores this tension in a work of incisive satire that sometimes hits a bit too close to home. Andrew Borriga is a writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic. And his debut novel, Victim, from Doubleday Books, is out now. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, man. I'm honored.
Well, I'm glad that it's a pleasure all around. Now, you live in Miami now, but you were born and raised in the Bronx borough of New York City, just like the protagonist in Victim, your debut work of fiction. Tell us a little bit about young Javier and how much your own childhood did or didn't resemble his.
Javi, yeah, like you mentioned, he grew up in the Bronx, very similar neighborhood, at least description-wise, to the one that I grew up in. In terms of the similarities, I also did live in this building where everyone really knew each other. I grew up living in a building actually for 25 years. So people really knew me from when I was a baby all the way to young adult and had friends inside this building. It was split on two sides, quite tall, 6-7 stories, and a lot of people packed into it. So it was just a little community. That's sort of the same place that I recreated for Javi. Similar to Javi, I also did enjoy writing quite young and reading. You know, it was something that I felt I had a talent for and that teachers told me I had a talent for. And I would say probably the other similarity is that we did have some trauma that we came from. I had family who were caught up in drug-related violence back in Puerto Rico, and that was sort of around us in the ether as well. Those things were all similar. I think where the main divergences are is that Javi, after he experiences something very traumatic that didn't happen to me personally, which is his father passing away in front of his eyes, he realizes that he gets a lot of sympathy for this from his school and later from guidance counselors, and more so that this like dream of his to be a famous writer, he can kind of like fast track it because of what he's experienced. And if he writes about it in a sort of heartrending, traumatic way for the admissions committee. So that's not something that I necessarily experienced, though I did when I was going through my college application process, did have people helping me with essay ideas. And I remember I wanted to write about running. I was a runner in high school. And when people found out that my own father had left our family quite young and that I grew up with these sort of responsibilities, raising my sisters and things, that it would be more effective for me to write about that. So I can't say that they were wrong, but I had these experiences where I realized that it would be more beneficial for me to write about the harder things I had experienced and like really dwell, try to paint those pictures, like that would resonate more with academic committees or later on with newspapers, magazines that I was writing for as I entered the sort of media space. There were quite a bit of similarities, but I think Javier's mindset, I think, was probably the biggest difference. Whereas I was like, felt a little weird about doing these things or maybe wouldn't even do them, which is like trying to paint trauma in a very dramatic way. Javi is more than willing to do it because he has this hustler mentality and realizes that this is sort of what people want. And if I give it to them, I'm going to get where I want to go.
Although you do make it clear early on in the book that Javi is at least initially resistant to it. One, because his mother raised him right.
Yeah.
And two, I think you make it clear that it's something that he never even conceived of as something to do because it was never just part of his, to use an overused phrase here, lived experience growing up in his Bronx neighborhood. But you open the book with Javi speaking directly to the reader, quote, "I wasn't trying to play the victim until the world taught me," and that's a key phrase, I think, "until the world taught me what a powerful grift it is. Believe it or not, all I wanted was to be successful, to hustle like my pops, but keep my life and freedom in the process. My desperate chase after your approval was really all about that. I needed that approval to be considered successful. I needed it to feel like my life mattered," end quote. So I'm sure you have lived a rich and storied life. You are still young, but I'm sure you've been through many different things that you could potentially mine for your first book. So was there an inciting incident or a moment in your life that made you want to pursue this specific topic, the idea of leveraging victimhood, either real or perceived, for power and prestige? What made you decide to focus on that for your first book?
It's a great question. And I wish I could tell you it like hit me like a thunderbolt one day, you know, but really it was this long process of trying to write authentically, I think, about the particular experience that I had coming from this poor neighborhood in the Bronx. We're in New York City, but it's very different from Manhattan and nowadays even parts of Brooklyn, right? Coming from that area to go to places like Cornell, where I went to university, I ended up writing in the New York Times quite young. I was like 18 when I first got into that building and I was like writing for them. So I had this like weird experience of making this sort of big class jump in a lot of ways, or at least on paper, or maybe not on paper. On paper, I was still quite poor, but like superficially, right? Like I was in these places, but then I would go back home.
The contrast in social circles probably was stark.
Yeah, exactly. In social circles. And it was just like very jarring from quite young. And I was just always trying to write about that. At first, it started trying to write about these two friends, Javi and Gio, who are still in the novel. But it started really with them trying to write about their divergence, right? Gio representing friends of mine that I had in real life who did go down the path of selling drugs, gangs, doing drugs, very unfortunate outcomes. And I went on to do everything right, so to speak. I was at a Cornell, New York Times newsroom, all these places. And I would just think like, how the fuck did I get here? And they're over there, you know, and that would just, it would mess with my mind. And so in the beginning, I was really writing about that. But the more and more I got involved with the media world and writing for different publications and freelancing and working with various editors and understanding what it is they were looking for from me, the more I realized there was like currency to the upbringing that I had and the sort of connection to my community that was sometimes going through these things that were being touched on in news stories, and particularly the tragic news stories, the shootings and the gang arrests and the police involved violence and these sorts of things. And I started to realize, you know, I understand, I should say, that my value in the eyes of a lot of these editors and these publications was that I had a tie to these places and that I could speak authentically, or at least seemingly speak authentically, about issues and this trauma.
One of the main topics we're going to be discussing today is what authentic means. And I want to go back to something you said just kind of offhandedly about how you grew up, quote unquote, poor.
Yeah.
One thing that Javi struggles with initially is the distance between his own perception of his economic upbringing with his mom growing up in a working class environment and how he is perceived by other people who are not from his own community, people like Mr. Martin, which we'll definitely delve into a little bit later. Did you grow up like Javi in that you did not perceive yourself to be poor until someone from a different economic or social strata told you that you were?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't think I was poor until I got to Cornell. That was precisely when I found out that I was quote unquote poor.
When you found out like it's a gender reveal.
Yeah, I was like, oh shit.
You're poor.
Yeah, basically like I got there and you know, you do orientation. Everyone's like, oh, what'd you do this summer? And people were like going off these crazy trips all over the world and doing these like mission service things and on their boats and skiing in these places I couldn't even pronounce. And I was like, I had a job, man. Working for this nonprofit, delivering packages all over the city and hanging out with my boys after. That was like the first time that I was like, people live different. And I kind of understood that having worked in Manhattan a little bit. And even that was always kind of an interesting barrier crossing, like just taking the train literally from my neighborhood in the Bronx to like 42nd Street. You know, it was like going to a whole other world. It was like 30 minutes. So I kind of understood that we live differently, but I still didn't think of myself as necessarily poor. I was actually like, I think I have more fun than you guys in my neighborhood. But then I got to Cornell and just extreme wealth all around me. Like I lived next to a kid whose parents were like Saudi oil barons and he just had a job lined up.
Wow.
He knew first day of freshman year, I don't need to do anything because my job is set. Kids who drove really nice cars, who just had like money given to them by their parents every month just to spend. I had three jobs in college, you know, like there was just clear differences. Growing up, my mom, single mom and was a social worker. Didn't make a whole lot of money, but we always had food. We never got evicted. Maybe the rent would be paid late, but it'd be paid. It was never anything to me that crazy compared to what I knew around me. Like I had friends who did go through those things, who experienced homelessness. And if their parents were around, they were raised by like a grandparent or uncle or something, or people who weren't really watching them. I felt pretty fortunate that I had the mother that I had and the upbringing that I had. And then when I got to a place like Cornell, it was this interesting reveal, like you said. Like, hey, there's a whole other world out there and they just think of you as poor, you know?
I think that touches on something that's really important and something that I think is so well constructed in the book. The word poor and like the way that Javi's mom reacts to it is that it is a loaded term because it is a term of pity. The way that other people use it is like, oh, you're poor, as in, oh, poor you. And the way that Javi's mom, and I think a lot of people who are working class, who are making ends meet, who, you know, have a roof over their heads. I think the judgment that is inherent in that word can make people feel a certain kind of way. And I think that there's a big distinction, which I think you draw very clearly in the book, between being working class or maybe not having a lot of money and the specific weighted word of poor and how people who aren't from that economic strata use it and what they mean when they use it to describe people from Javi's background.
Yeah, it felt more like a label. Because I, you know, whatever, they got more money than me. It doesn't really matter. Like, we could still be friends. It didn't bother me. But it was more like the label, oh, you're less than. And this is not across the board. I met many great friends and many of them had a lot of money and they never talked about it. And we're still cool to this day. But there was, I would say in general, more widespread, like, you're like defective. Like, you're like the spoiled banana at the end.
Yeah, like you're missing a limb or something. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there was a treatment like that. And for me, because I never saw myself that way and because I come from a good family and we're prideful and we're proud of what we are and where we come from and the growth that we've made. And so I was just like, fuck you. You know, that's
not. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like it kind of got me angry when I would experience that. It's like, you're not better than me. And in fact, one of the things that I learned quite quickly, you know, that's something I explored in the novel is that while a lot of these people that I met, and not just at Cornell, again, in places like the New York Times, I would experience this a lot as well from more senior people kind of looking at me, is that while they might have had credentials, mannerisms, and words and things that they'd learned that I hadn't, I actually did feel that I had a leg up in a lot of ways because I understood things like street smarts that they didn't understand. I could kind of read people a lot easier and I found my way. It took a little bit to come into my own confidence and realize that I did have a skill set that they didn't have, but once I did, it was totally fine. And I found my space and I found my way in campus and made a lot of friends and had a good time my last couple of years. But it took me sort of realizing like these kinds of people have certain skills or ways of speaking or access to things that I don't, but so do I, to things that they will never have, you know? And the trick is that I can learn theirs and they can't really learn mine, because they'd have to go to places that they don't really want to go. So once I understood that, it became a lot easier for me. And that was something that I tried to imbue in the novel through Javi, that he grew up around. His dad was a drug dealer and in the streets and stuff. And so he has this understanding of power and intangible qualities that he can use to his own will on campus.
Well, let's get into it. And fair warning to our listeners, there are going to be some spoilers for the first half of this book in this conversation. So fair warning. Javi's dad, as you mentioned, was a drug dealer, mostly absent father. And Javi sees him shot and killed in Puerto Rico at age 12. At the beginning of chapter 2, Javi says, quote, "It's hard to describe how I felt after Pops died. It's hard to describe losing a person who was only kind of there, a person who appeared and disappeared like a ghost." And then shortly after that, he says, quote, "I don't know if Pops dying was really the beginning of it all, but I do know that when I got back to the Bronx after his murder, I got my first taste of the high that comes from being a victim. In short order, I learned that I was no longer just a poor kid from the neighborhood like anyone else. I was one of those tragic kids," end quote. And what Javi realizes is that he can use the death of his father, a man who was just sort of barely there in his life, as a card to play for sympathy at school. Teachers give him more attention. They give him time off. They give him free trips to the nurse's office. Quote, "For the first time, I realized my tragedy could translate into personal gain," end quote. So I have a couple questions here, Andrew. On the one hand, we do see that Javi is at times going through real pain in the wake of his father's murder. Sometimes his tears are real, but he's a smart kid, so he also understands that there's a system to be worked here. So from your perspective, how do you think we got here? How did we create a system that is perhaps overly lenient to people who are perceived correctly or not to be victims? And what, in your view, is a healthier way to comfort or counsel people, especially a kid in this instance, who have experienced harm?
Those are big questions. You know, I wish I had easy answers. I mean, I think what I was trying to get at there is that these systems, particularly school systems, are dealing with kids who have gone through real serious trauma. I know, because I was in there. I have friends who've been through that. I have friends who are teachers now, older like me, and dealing with these kids. And I think there's an impulse to approach these kids with kid gloves in a way.
Like they're broken almost.
Like they're broken. Yeah. They're broken now and we just got to contain them. Whereas it's interesting that while they send Javi to the nurse and things like that, there's no therapist. There's no, let's put him in a class where somebody can look after him, make sure he's doing the work. More of a proactive approach. And I think there are school systems and places that do that, but they generally have the resources to do that. I think that in reality, there are probably a lot of cases where kids like Javi, they're probably in school systems where they ignored in a lot of ways, or they don't have the resources to kind of deal with them in a healthy way, or in a way that's going to help them process what they've experienced and move past it. In a lot of ways, the easier thing to do is push them off to the side. Not in a way like we don't care about you, but like go to the office, go take a nap, or get them out of the classroom and away from things that will probably help stimulate them in some ways. But I don't know, it's a really hard question. I wasn't necessarily trying to suggest in passages like that one that there should be a different approach. I think I was more so trying to set the stage of this kid experiencing some real trauma and then realizing that there are some perks that come along with it, to sort of give you, the reader, a sense like this happened early on. And then what happens later when he meets his guidance counselor, that's just kind of the next bigger step. And he sees it's beyond just like a nap in school. I can get some real tangible value, money, experiences, opportunities from this kind of posture.
It touches on an interesting cultural shift that I feel has happened or is still happening, where in the past, to one of your earlier points, and I think that this still goes on today, but I think it definitely went on a lot more when, let's say, my dad was a kid, where if someone went through a tragedy or a tough time, they were either just ignored or just said, "Hey, kid, deal with it. Get on with your life. I don't want to hear it." You know, I think that probably led to a lot of internalized, really messed up psychological trauma for people of our parents' generation or older, which was kind of just the standard for all of human civilization until 5 minutes ago. But I do worry that perhaps in an effort to correct for that, we have perhaps gone a little too far in the other direction, where we either treat the trauma as an identity marker within people, like you are your trauma or your trauma is you, or like, yeah, treat them like this broken thing or like a bird with a broken wing or something. And I worry that we've perhaps overcorrected a bit too far, because I think that absorbing trauma as part of your crystallized identity is perhaps as unhealthy as not dealing with it at all.
Yeah, for sure. And that's something that I was trying to explore, because I learned that personally. My dad left quite young. And like I said, we lost people in our family. And I was very young when that happened. There were things that I had working in me quite young that developed into this chip on my shoulder or this identity in some ways. And it took me to getting into my young adulthood, my early 20s, to really understand that by overly dwelling on it or overly defining myself by that was actually kind of limiting me. You know, in the case of my own father, for example, it really hindered me to try and become a husband and get married and have kids, you know, because I was just like, well, I didn't grow up with a dad. Like, I don't know what a good dad looks like. I had overly masculine models around me. Like, I'm going to mess some kid up and I'm going to do what my dad did. And that was really me sort of attaching the trauma to my present day and just like, there's no way I'm going to get past it. And through therapy, through started attending church, I had to do a lot of growth internally to realize I can separate whatever I experienced in the past from what I want to do moving forward. And it doesn't have to necessarily define me, and I can learn from it. But it's a really hard process. And it's much harder than just saying, man, you had it tough. What can you do? Just living in it. And like you said, letting it sort of define you. And I do think that we've sort of moved into this moment where, like, it's part of the book, right? It's like people are happy to allow their trauma to define them and like yell about it from the rooftops or on Twitter or in these essays or in various venues and making their identity out of it. And I just started to notice that as I was personally growing through my 20s and early 30s and think like, I don't know, is that really, is that what we should be doing here? Is that really a healthy way to go about this? It's important to talk about it and care about it and connect, but there was a weird willingness to dwell in it and not move past it.
Yeah, I relate to that a lot. I mean, having gone through therapy myself on and off for the last decade, it often seems like the signals that we get from society, especially to kind of paraphrase Javi here, if you come from the quote unquote right background with a tragic history, it seems like what society is telling us often is almost antithetical to what we learn in therapy. In therapy, at least in good therapy, you learn that you are not defined forever by the things that happen to you. You are not destined to become your father. You are not destined to make the same mistakes that you made as a kid. You can learn from those events and become someone new, become something more. But oftentimes it feels like the signals that society sends in terms of the incentives that it offers is that no. Not only is this who you are, you should continuously mine it and return to it over and over again for content or for clout or whatever it is. And you set up this brilliant contrast between the characters of Gio and Anaïs. Gio, as you mentioned, is Javi's childhood friend in their working class neighborhood whose mother killed herself when Gio was about, I think, 9 years old. And how Gio copes with that real actual tragedy in part by seeking belonging and identity in a group of older peers who turn him on to drug dealing. And then contrasted to that, you have Anaïs, the half Puerto Rican and Dominican, half white woman that Javi falls in love with at the prestigious Donlan University in upstate New York, who grew up in a stable, upper-middle-class home to parents that seemingly love and support her. But she feels adrift in her identity, and so in an effort to manifest quote-unquote authenticity, turns to activism and creates this outward-facing, radicalized version of herself in college that doesn't reflect the suburban experience of her childhood. So I'd love for you to speak a bit about that contrast, what it means to you as it pertains to your own life and experience, and what it says about how people deal with crises of identity.
Yeah, that's a great parallel you drew out there, because that's definitely something I was aiming for. I mean, characters like Gio, I was really thinking about people close to me, family members, friends. I look at their lives, I'm like, geez, you know, you've been through some shit, right? I think of my grandmother who grew up in Loíza in Puerto Rico, which is a smaller town, and it's known for like its cultural history, but also, you know, it's quite impoverished as well. She lived through a lot of things that she would just sometimes say in passing in stories, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ. But I've never ever heard her complain about any of that stuff. I guess people like Gio were meant to represent that oftentimes the people who are offline, away from these hypermedia spaces, who do go through these things, a lot of them just kind of have to like move past it. And they're still hurt in different ways, and they're still coping, and maybe a lot of them don't receive therapy or don't even believe in it. Maybe they find it in the church or in various outlets. But oftentimes, you'd be disrespecting them if you try to label them as a victim and treat them in that way. They would reject that. Contrasted with Anaïs, who represented people I've seen online, on campus, people in the media, where it's like they're almost looking for a crusade to hop on and to define themselves by in a lot of ways. And if you look a little bit deeper or dig an inch deep or whatever, they come from these backgrounds where things were okay for the most part. You know, maybe they went through something, you know, people go through everything, everyone's trauma is relative. But there was a sense I got that sometimes the most fervent people were those trying to maybe mask up the fact that things were okay growing up and didn't have anything like super dramatic or drastic to, you know, share. And so hopping on these social movements was kind of like their way to do that. So that was kind of the parallel that I was trying to draw, but also make Anaïs a well-rounded character. I don't think she's somebody who's as cynical, you know, as Javi. She's actually quite idealistic. I think she does believe in a lot of things that she's advocating for, but you can also see that it's also a cover, or it allows her to feel accepted in this time where she feels like if she's not doing these things and if she's just being authentic, quote unquote, to herself and to her like suburban upbringing and what she used to like, that it's not as cool or doesn't have the same cachet as if she's being an online activist. There's a lot of weird nuances that I was trying to tease out there, but also try to paint characters that feel like well-rounded people and don't feel like stand-ins, because that was a big goal of mine. I didn't want to just create some straw man, quote unquote, SJW type person. Like, I wanted to create somebody who you can maybe understand and like is complex.
A little over a decade ago in 2013, I got into a relationship with someone who was, I would say, very much like Anaïs. Not identical. Obviously, that would be a little strange. But I found myself in these circles of people who were about my age. I was about 30 at the time. And I was often the only white guy in the room. And they had all come from schools like Yale, Harvard, Princeton. But they would constantly speak about themselves as if they were oppressed. Even though I come from a middle-class background from Northern California, both my parents are together, they have a great marriage. But often, just for contrast, I would be the poorest person in a given room most of the time, which just says how wealthier a lot of these people I came to know were. But they would repeatedly invoke a kind of oppression that they kept referencing that they were experiencing that I didn't really see reflected in any kind of reality. Ultimately, my experiences in those social circles over about a 5-year period led me to actually starting this podcast. And in episode 2, I spoke with journalist Zed Jelani, and he has this 2020 essay in Tablet magazine called Identity Theft. I imagine you'll relate to it quite a bit. He talks about this concept of stolen valor, not in the traditional military sense, but as it relates to claiming victimhood status on behalf of people who are actually experiencing hardship. I pulled a passage from this essay as it relates, I think, to your novel. Quote, "This new form of stolen valor isn't only legal, it is increasingly encouraged. But I refuse to partake in it because it would be wrong to use my status as a racial and religious minority to get ahead, because I know that I'm actually doing quite well. I'm a middle-class professional who lives in a safe community and rarely faces any type of discrimination. Yes, there are Muslims in the United States and across the world who are underprivileged. One of the most illuminating experiences in my life was meeting children in Karachi who couldn't have been older than 8 or 9, getting up every day and working for a living. In a world where some people who share the same ancestors as I do are literally engaged in child labor, I would feel ashamed to hop onto Twitter and complain about how underprivileged I am because of my ethnic background," end quote. And we see this in action at Donlin University at the LTC, or Latino Thriving Center, specifically with the character of Anaïs, who, to your point, Andrew, you craft her as a very well-rounded human being in the same way that the people that I knew 5-10 years ago were well-rounded people who were, I think, going through a real crisis of identity. But as I mentioned earlier, she has a white mom, came from a largely white suburb in Albany, New York. But in college, she's describing white people as scheming overseers who ultimately control every outcome for black and brown people somehow behind the scenes. So what causes this disconnect between one's personal lived experience, like a nice childhood surrounded by, you know, like a lot of times white people who were like probably mostly kind, And the language that comes later, maybe the kind that you encountered in college in activist circles, this kind of performative resentment. What do you think causes that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the generation that sort of like societal changes happening around this time. I'm thinking of particularly 2013, 2014, 15, 16, where there was, I don't know, something in the ether, like things just changed. At least it felt to me growing up through that time that it became cool. There's a status associated with having oppression that you can cling to or talk about or have define you, or also in a lot of ways, these identity markers. I just remember this period where everybody had like 10 flags in their Twitter bio, you know, like I'm this, I'm that, I'm this. It's like everything, but like, I'm not white, you know, I'm not white, you know? And it was kind of just funny to me to see that, like, what is going on here? Why is everybody all of a sudden doing this type of thing? And I think from what I saw, a lot of that posturing, particularly if you didn't grow up in that way or didn't have these real things to pull from, was to not feel like you were left out. But it's weird to even say that because I feel like the people who could be the king of the poverty Olympics, they were rarely the ones who were out there screaming about it. Like I could tweet stuff about my childhood online and get all these likes, but it just felt weird to do that or write like a personal essay that has nothing to do with anything topical in the news just to like air out something tragic that happened to me. And I never did that because I was like, but why? Why would I do that? But there was a demand for it during this time period. And I'm sure somebody who's smarter could explain some of the other factors going on. I'm sure there were like economic, political factors going on that led to this. But for my vantage point, it just felt like this weird bubble. And it was a drastic one because, again, I started working for the New York Times in 2009. I was 18 years old. And I couldn't get them to write anything about the Bronx or like my background if I wanted to. It was just like, what are you talking about? Write about the crime there or write about the grittiness. It was rarely sympathetic at all. You know, it was more like we were just still the heathens in the Bronx, you know, write about it. I can count on my hands the number of people who were given the latitude to write in empathetic ways. And then something just suddenly shift where it's like all we're looking for now is these really heartrending stories that are completely different from what was in demand in 2009. I saw that dramatic shift, and maybe it was the rise of online use. That probably had a lot to do with it. The fact that you could get a lot of currency on places like Twitter from talking about your perceived oppression, whether it was real or not, and sort of having this like moral vantage point, establishing yourself as someone from the right moral mountain. I think that probably had a lot to do with it as well. Sort of the online dynamics happening at the time. You would just get a lot of likes and followers, and it was a weird thing to experience. And that was partly what I was trying to get at in the book. What was going on there? What are we doing there?
I think you did so successfully. There are two kind of simultaneous things that are happening, one at a society level, and then one at kind of a more personal level to these kids or young adults who come from these backgrounds where they're economically successful and yet racialized, right? I think at a society-wide level, to touch on what you were saying earlier about how you couldn't get them to let you write a sympathetic, nuanced portrait of the Bronx if you wanted to. They just kind of wanted to see it, to use your phrasing, as like this group of heathens who are kind of otherized, right? I think historically in the United States, that was the status quo for most of American history. If you weren't white, and even if white, like you can see a lot of times throughout American history, if you're poor and white and Southern, they don't give a crap about you either. And they're not going to write sympathetic pieces about you either. But most of the time that was racialized. So it's like you either write about it when crime happens there or you don't write about it at all. The Onion kind of satirized this very phenomenon all the way back in 2008. They had this article with the headline, "Hurricane bound for Texas slowed by large landmass to the south." And that large landmass to the south was Cuba. So it's this idea that like anything that is outside of what we denote as kind of worthwhile, which oftentimes overlapped historically with white, was just not worth writing about. Thankfully, we're making progress there. I think on the personal level, though, which you explore really well and sympathetically in the book is, and something that I viewed up close in these circles that I couldn't really grasp was it seemed like almost, and this could be a good way to transition to talking about someone like Mr. Martin, is in the same way that you would have a character like Mr. Martin, this guidance counselor from a wealthy private school in Riverdale, would kind of view kids like Javi, working class black and brown kids, as kind of the authentic, Latino or Hispanic experience and something to be kind of admired as the ideal, authentic experience of what it meant to be that thing in this well-meaning but pitying way, it seemed sometimes, and then I want to throw it to you, is sometimes these young adults or kids who shared the same ethnic background, let's say, as someone like Javi, but came from a suburban neighborhood, somehow felt that by coming from a great home in a great neighborhood, mostly not surrounded by people of their same ethnicity, that somehow, in the same way Mr. Martin viewed Javi, they viewed themselves as somehow inauthentic because they weren't poor or because they didn't come from a broken home. And it just, I never quite solved why that was, but I felt a lot of sympathy for those people because they seemed to be really struggling with somehow they weren't enough because they weren't authentic in the way that society perceives authenticity when it comes to kids like Javi.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the representations that we see in media and films and music videos and TV. Growing up, there's rarely Latino characters in movies. And when they are, they're usually drug dealers or drug users or the sexy side chick, or they're the struggling single mom or the maid who marries the white guy and gets out of poverty. You know, like these are the representations that we see are given to us growing up. And then they're very much at odds with how we actually grow up. They were at odds with me. And I even had drug dealers in my family and all these types of things. But still, like, that's not how it is. You know what I mean? Like, I could imagine even more so if I'm Puerto Rican from the island and my parents are successful lawyers and I come here and people are like, oh, you live in, I don't know, the Bronx, or you have, you know, like they imagine certain things about your upbringing. And then when it doesn't fit that box, I could imagine that they would feel out of the group or not accepted. And that to me is real diversity, right? That's the diversity I care about, is like,
yeah,
making sure that kids who come from various classes within their given ethnicity are allowed to express themselves and feel fine doing that. I think it's so weird when we try to box people into something based on these stereotypes that have been contrived by mostly white people.
But it creates a cycle, to your point, where the narratives might initially come from white people, but then somehow they're absorbed and then reinforced often within the community, even if those narratives are false.
Yeah, because it's like the barometer, especially you go to a place like an elite college and these people have a certain idea of who you are and what you're supposed to be like. And when you don't fit that, you're casted out in a sense. And so you have two choices. It's, I'm going to make it on my own and do my own thing, which is ultimately a harder, probably lonelier choice that's more fruitful in the end, I would say. But the other one is to play up certain things about me, or I have a distant cousin who was from the island and maybe was poorer, or I know somebody who knows somebody who was a drug dealer. Like, you can start trying to fit into these little boxes in certain ways. And I think some kids do that, and that's sad. I don't think they do it in a cynical manner at all. I think they're trying to find belonging. That's something I'm also exploring in the book. Like, Gio is trying to find belonging and he finds it in gangs, which a lot of kids do. Gangs for a lot of people are belonging.
Well, the contrast between Gio and Anais and then ultimately Javi is like what we see across these different social strata is ultimately just people conforming to the social rules of whatever their environment is out of a desire for group acceptance, love, and belonging.
Exactly. You know, because nobody wants to feel like they're left out. It's something that can be particularly damaging if you feel like you can't be yourself.
It's a wound that you just inflict on yourself over time.
Yeah. And I think it's changing. I do. I'm an optimist. I do think that we are seeing more varied, nuanced representations, even in these films and stuff that I was mentioning. Like, I think a film like American Fiction coming out, I love that, you know, and that it's accepted. And even if you didn't love the film, like the fact that it's out and it's like winning an Oscar, it's like a big deal.
Yes.
Let a show like Atlanta exists, you know.
Abbott Elementary.
These are great shows and the characters are nuanced. And I love that. The more I see of that, the more I'm like, yes, okay, finally, you know, this is what I'm talking about. Diversity isn't like, okay, we're going to have more voices, but they're all going to just talk about their oppression and trauma.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, and we're still making progress, but it wasn't that long ago that it felt like every movie that came out with black leads was about slavery or poverty.
Yeah, man. What the fuck?
Yeah. Like, how about a rom-com?
Yeah. The Latino community, we haven't gotten there yet. It's mostly shows like Narcos, and I don't know, but it's slowly. So I'm hopeful that we're going to get there too, but that's what I want to see.
Yeah, actually. And on that point, I want to pull a passage from the book that I think touches on that. Javi is describing his experience first arriving at college, and he says, quote, "One of the most insightful things I'd learned when I got to Donlan was about the wide range of Latinos or Hispanics or whatever the hell they wanted to call us. There were white ones, poor ones, dark ones, and rich ones who, despite their heavy accents, knew exactly what color ski slope was the hardest to go down. They were from countries I'd never met anyone from before: Colombia, Peru, Argentina, Chile. Some of the rich ones were from Puerto Rico too, but when I tried to claim a shared heritage with them and told them about the town my family was from and my childhood in New York, they quickly told me that they were real Puerto Ricans and I was something different. I'm going to try and pronounce this correctly.
New Yorican.
Okay, I get you. All the different categories separating us were hard to grasp and keep track of. Before Donlin, everyone in my orbit was either from PR or DR, Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic, and to anyone else who wasn't one of us, we were just Spanish, end quote. And this is kind of a big question, Andrew, but you've probably garnered that I like to ask big questions. What does the Latino or Hispanic identity mean to you? Do you see it as something coherent, more of a political identity, or something else?
To me, it's this extremely huge, varied universe. But I think for many people, there is an effort to limit it to either the way you look, or you speak Spanish, or you don't speak Spanish, or you come from a certain type of class, or you don't. I think it's particularly for people who aren't Latino, or are like really far removed from their Latino identity. Ironically, there tends to be an effort to create this box around it. Whereas I live in Miami, man, like it's like 80% Latino here. Like all the nations are here represented. But if you speak English here, you have a hard time living. But you got to speak some Spanish for real.
Yeah, I've heard that.
You just got to speak some Spanish. And if you don't, like, you're shit out of luck, to be honest with you. And there's so much diversity here. There's so many nuances even between the various nations. Like, I'm Puerto Rican, my wife is Colombian. While we had similar educational experiences and similar backgrounds, we're super different in many ways, and our family are super different in many ways. We have words that are different in Spanish. Beans for me are like habichuelas, and for her, they're frijoles. And now we have kids, and it's like, are we going to teach them frijoles? We're going to teach them habichuelas. You know, we're like, it's like a little eternal war, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's all these nuances and class differences. I mean, like in Miami, it's bugged out. You can be in the store and see a woman who looks like a white woman, and she speaks better Spanish than everybody else on the line. Even though they might look to you, quote unquote, more Hispanic or Latino, she might have actually better control. Like, she might actually know Spanish, the other ones don't. So these things happen every day. And so to me, I understand the need for the category, right? There's like senses and there's technical things that probably need to be counted and filled out or whatever. So we need to have Hispanic or Latino or whatever. But to suggest that it's like a box and that if you don't have like these five qualifications, you don't fit in the box. To me, it's like a silly thing because it's extremely wide and diverse. It's not even a box. I don't know. It's like an ocean. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's the case probably with every ethnicity or every box you try to draw around a group. We're constantly having these fights over what do we call so-and-so group and whether they need their own box. And now we have too many boxes. So there's this grouping that tends to happen here in the States, and Latinos are just one product of it. But to me, it's an extremely diverse group of people who probably are more defined by where they actually come from than this idea of being Latino, to be honest.
One thing that is a recurring theme on this show that's really important to me is that there is no wrong way to be what you immutably are. You are no less Latino if you do or don't speak Spanish, right? I mean, one of the things that was a bit of a culture shock for me coming to Los Angeles, because I'm half Armenian on my mother's side, three or four generations removed from me, my great grandma came over after the genocide. She came here in 1920. So I'm pretty far removed. I don't speak any Armenian. I think my mom, my sister, and I were the only ethnic Armenians growing up in our small town in Northern California. So then moving to Los Angeles was like a huge culture shock because there are a ton of Armenians here, right? But a lot of them are either from Armenia or the children of people who are from Armenia. And so for me, I would sometimes even just avoid telling someone that I was Armenian because it would ultimately come with a series of questions and I would fail all of them, quote unquote. Like, I don't speak it. I've never been there. I don't know the name of every food that you're referencing. Like, I know kebabs and hummus and lahmacun and some of the other ones, but like, it's why in some way I relate to the struggle of someone like Anais. I relate to the struggle of the activists that I ran with for those years, because when society is giving us categories that ultimately are arbitrarily created, like these categories of whatever they are, white, Latino, Black, etc., like they have historical connotations, but ultimately, if we wanted to categorize our similarities and dissimilarities across an entirely different metric, Andrew, I'm sure you and I share a lot in common.
For sure, yeah.
But when we just say the Latino vote, how are Latinos voting in 2024? It's like, well, who are you talking about, man? Like, are you talking about Tejanos? Are you talking about Cubans?
I fucking hate that shit, man.
But when we construct the world in this way, people will then try and fit within it. And I think it creates a lot of pain. And that's something that I'm really interested in. But I want to make sure that we have time for Mr. Martin here, because we've talked about him a little bit, but he's this guidance school counselor from, like I mentioned earlier, this wealthier private school who, as like an act of charity or public service, offers guidance once a week to kids in the honors classes at Javi's school. And he's kind of the first person who lets Javi in on this idea that mining a tragic history, whether real or exaggerated, has an institutional power to it. And Javi's able to kind of leverage that to get into a really good school and getting into Donlin University. Did you ever encounter someone like Mr. Martin growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I had well-meaning people help me during my college application process, and people I'm still close to and really friends with, not as condescending or things, just Mr. Martin. You know, I played him up for the purpose of the book. I had people in my life, particularly when I was this age, like trying to go to college, and I had good grades and hadn't necessarily gone to like the best schools, but people could see that I was talented and smart and mature, didn't have like great SAT scores. And there was this sense of like, hey, the essays will help you out. And I think once they knew a little bit about my background, it was like, hey, the quirky essay you want to write, like save that for something else. You know what I mean? This is a big moment for you. You might want to write about your dad leaving or why you're so mature and how that factored in. And they were real stories, you know, it wasn't like they were telling me to make something up or whatever, but it was more like, this one's probably going to play better. And to be honest, I don't fault them for that because they were right. And I'm sure that my essays played a role while I got into a place like Cornell, to be honest with you. I can't necessarily fault them for it, but I think what I'm trying to get at with him is more so he's meant to play a larger role. Like he's somebody who's supposed to stand in for like this voice coming to students, a lot of students of color that are not in Javi's situation, are more like Anais, or they're maybe like Asian, you know, like I feel the Asian plight is serious, you know, like they have all the grades and everything, and they have to like make themselves seem less Asian in some ways for college admissions. I'm trying to speak to like a bigger thing that wherever your status in life is, if you're a marginalized person trying to get into one of these schools, you are being coached, you know, in a lot of ways, if you have the right coaches around you to do these types of things. And I guess more so trying to think about like, what does that do? In Javi's case, it sets him off down a path of there's something to be gained from this and I can keep doing it. I think in other cases, it can begin this process of seeing yourself as a victim in some ways when you didn't necessarily see yourself in that way. Or even I have to do these things to gain acceptance to a place like a Princeton or Yale or something like that. It can't just be on my own merits, which I think does something psychologically. And so I was just trying to explore that. But again, make Mr. Martin somebody who ultimately is trying to help Javi. You know, I think he's insensitive and he like necessarily doesn't realize the way he's saying things are coming off to someone like Javi. But he feels like he's being righteous. And so I was just trying to explore all of that. You know, there's a reason why I wrote like a novel and not like a sermon or like a nonfiction thing that's with research. I love fiction. And
well, Javi would have written this as nonfiction. So it's credit to you that you.
yeah. But for me, I feel like in the space of a novel, if you do it right and you create these characters who feel like real people, you can tease out a lot of these nuances and maybe not provide ready-made answers, but they lead to conversations like this one. And that's been one of the best things I've experienced post-publication is just seeing the various reactions to people in the book and what people are taking away from it and what they think is the message or what their arguments are after reading the book or what it brought up for them. You know, like to me, that's beautiful because that's precisely what I was trying to do, just stimulate thought around these people and their motivations and are they right or are they wrong. Sitting here, I can't tell you that coaching a kid who is like me today, like especially now with the way that the rules have changed for affirmative actions, like you might be right to coach that kid to like if they have something like that to write about, they probably have a better chance, you know what I mean? But it's a fucked up system that's where we are, and I just wanted to explore that.
This might just be the English major in me, But one of the reasons why I hate the word system or systems, you know, like when we talk about systems of oppression, right?
Yeah.
It's inaccurate because I think what it implies is coordination. When really, I think what happens in society with something like this, right? All of a sudden, kids from, to paraphrase something that Javi says in the book, if you have the right skin color or the right background, you're kind of incentivized to write these stories of woe is me in order to get into college. Because ultimately, the positive thing that these colleges want to do is they want to increase representation of kids of Javi's background who might be from underrepresented, quote unquote, backgrounds. But in this kind of uncoordinated organism that is moving and changing, the thing we call society, is in the same way that we're only just beginning to break this cycle when it comes to Black Americans' representation in cinema, of not everything is a poor Black woman trying to raise a kid, you know, in a single household. Not every movie is about that. Not every movie takes place in 1862. I think the same exact thing is happening with these college essays, where in an effort, in a well-meaning effort to increase representation, they are taking multidimensional human beings, right? Like in your dedication at the beginning of the book, you said to all the ghetto nerds worldwide, right? The reason I bring that up is, if I'm going to infer from it, you probably grew up as like a nerdy kid who had a bunch of different interests. I grew up as a nerd who was really interested in comic books and movies and all these other things. And I think what happens is when you take kids from underprivileged backgrounds, quote unquote, and instead of saying, hey, Andrew, write about the thing that you were really interested in as like a nerd growing up in the Bronx, or like something you're really passionate about, and that will be your essay because you're a fully formed multidimensional human being. If instead you tell that kid, hey, write about this, in the same way that if all you see in cinema is people in impoverished backgrounds who happen to look like you, well-meaning or not, you are sending the exact same message. And I think that's the thing that really concerns me.
Yeah. And that's some of what I'm trying to tease out there is like, he is well-meaning, but it's like that message ultimately kind of infects someone like Javi. I think, yeah, like it sets him off. Like it's clear in the book. That's the moment where his eyes open. He's like, aha, this is something I could pimp out. This is a whole new avenue for me. And that's really an important part of the book.
During this book tour, when you're at these events or when you're speaking about the book, do you ever have anyone kind of looking at you like Mr. Martin now? Even though the book is at its heart exploding these categories, when you speak of your experience through the story of Javi, do you ever notice that same look of like deference, or like get the sense that the person sitting across from you like doesn't see you for your full self, but rather is like an avatar for the Hispanic experience?
You know, not yet, I gotta say.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it hasn't been a wide tour yet. I mean, the first place was in the Bronx, and I was like, people know me there. And it's like, they were more just happy in Brooklyn. And yeah, I was in Brooklyn and Tampa. No, I mean, to be honest with you, I haven't got that. I think they're just like so happy I wrote something like this. And usually there are other, mostly, not always, but mostly other people of color who are like, this is excellent. I identify with this so much. Like, this is my college experience. Or it's, this is making me think a lot. And thanking me for that. So like, I haven't really felt that yet, to be honest. That's been good. That's been good to see. But I feel it's almost hard to read the book. And then, I mean, you really got to be committed if you read the book and you come away still trying to see me like that. I'm just like, man, I would always respect you because I'm just like, you're not changing, you know? Yes.
You are committed. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. You know?
Would it be an ideal to live in a world that exists beyond the label of, let's say, POC, like person of color? I understand its reason for being, especially as like a political organizational group, but going back to how you were describing Hispanic Latino and how that encompasses so many often contradicting identities that are so diverse, POC feels kind of like that on steroids.
Yeah, yeah, it does. Yeah. And even BIPOC. I mean, I always say that sounds like a, I don't know, like an evil villain or something.
Oh no, it's BIPOC.
Yeah. I was like, what the fuck is that? Like, I was like, who came up with that? But yeah, no, I do. I think it's just hard to speak about like wide swaths of people. And maybe the lesson is like, we shouldn't do that. You know, we just should never do that or really try not to. But
right,
if you are doing that, you have to give them some name. And I think a lot of these terms, the reason why they're constantly being discarded and new ones pop up was like, used to be minorities, marginalized, and now POC and BIPOC. Then there's going to be a new one like in a year or two from now, I'm sure. And I think it's because holes are constantly being poked in them and will probably forever be poked in them because they don't really work. They're just like trying to describe this mass of people that's really indescribable in a generalization such as that. There's just so many nuances to everybody. It's hard to speak to those nuances in a like short clipped way. I think a lot of the stuff comes from the political realm or from the journalism media realm, because we have to try and like describe, I was going to say inches, like column inches, because that's my mind. I'm like a print journalist, but nobody cares anymore about that. But, you know, in a 2,000 word online piece, you're trying to write about these wide swaths of people, like you have to have these little monikers to fall back on. Or if you're giving a speech about people you're trying to convince to vote for you, you kind of have to use these things. So I think they were created to like fill this need, not necessarily because we naturally need them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think the same thing about woke. I hate that word. I don't even really know what it means, but like in some cases, it's the only word I can reach for, but it kind of makes me sound icky. Cause then like the quote anti-woke people are also, they can have their own bullshit too. And so personally, I would be happy if they went away, but I think our society still has a use for them. And so they'll probably just keep evolving.
You're right that it's the language we have. And so we use that language. But I can't help but think of how, you know, the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for blue.
Oh, really?
They obviously could see blue, but they didn't have a word to describe it. So they would often, for instance, describe the sea as being like wine colored. They just didn't have a word to describe it. And I think sometimes that's what we struggle with now in America. Because you travel the world and different countries have different ways to talk about subjects like race or ethnicity. You go to Brazil, people are simply not going to use the same language to describe ethnic and racial differences as they do in the States. And I think to yes and you, Andrew, my humble wish would just be that we add more. It's not just Latino or in my case, Armenian or white or black or whatever. It's Andrew from the Bronx who lives in Miami now and he's a writer and he's interested in XYZ things. Or it's like Michael who lives in Los Angeles and grew up in Northern California, and he's really into probably Mission Impossible a little too much. Just the things that make us who we are that transcend, I think, these racial categories that we think so often gives us information, but honestly, very rarely gives us very good information. And one of the reasons why I so loved this book, I honestly would give it probably the strongest recommendation that I could give any book in the 100 episodes that I have done of this show.
That's an honor, man. Thank you.
Of course, it's well earned, is that it gets at like the nuances and the complexities of how we kind of all exist in this society right now and how we are all in some ways searching for, as we said earlier, Andrew, like identity, belonging, love, representation, validation, and how we're kind of all in our own ways grasping around using what the system is providing us and sometimes coming up short. And I just haven't read anything quite like it. I really, really appreciate that about this novel. Is there anything that's sort of catching your mind now? A topic of interest that now that you've gotten this off your chest that is really animating you now?
Yeah. First, thank you, man. What you said about the book is really awesome. And I'm grateful. So I appreciate that you took all that away from it and for having me on.
Oh, of course.
But yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's almost hard to talk about the book because I feel like I just left everything on the page. Like all these thoughts and things were in my mind. I just got it in there. And that's a beautiful thing about writing a book. And I feel like, all right, if you want to hear what I have to say, it's all there. That's all it is. But it's cool because now that I've got that out, I feel like I'm focused on this next thing, which is my new obsession that I think about constantly. Parenthood, fatherhood, masculinity, trying to be a father in this age or relatively younger father, I think, compared to society. Like I was like 29 when my first kid was born, which is like not that young compared to people in my family, but like in my friends and everyone, they were like, you're having a kid? Like, why would you do that? Like, you're going to end your life. And there's a lot of weird things happening around parenthood right now, I feel like, particularly with my millennial generation, is a lot of us are transitioning into parenthood. Is my kid going to end the planet? Is it ethical to have a kid today? Or do I want to give up the freedom? I mean, I think a lot of these things are age, things that have been well done for probably a long period of time, but perhaps we're just talking about it so much now because of the online outlets that we have. I'm trying to write something right now. I'm kind of well into it. It's like exploring what it means to be a youngish father in this period in time. And also someone trying to understand, like, what does it mean to be a good father, especially if you haven't had a role model, didn't grow up with a father, and you're trying to trade out your previous versions of masculinity and manhood for new ones, but the new ones also don't really feel like they fit you either. And the goalposts are constantly changing and you're sort of like lost, and how that can sometimes allow you to drift toward these figures like an Andrew Tate or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of these people, for men, feel voids of understanding of who they're supposed to be or what they're supposed to look like. And so I'm trying to figure out a way to get all that again in like an entertaining, humorous way, sort of like what I did with this novel.
I look forward to reading whatever you write next. And I really enjoyed this conversation, Andrew. I hope that the only thing you're a victim of is the success that this book deserves. So thank you so much for your time. Thanks so much for writing this book. And thanks for a great conversation.
Thank you so much, man. This was excellent. And it was an honor to be on your show.